Engaging conversation on the most urgent problem of our day and what you can do about it.
Now, the End Abortion Podcast by Priests for Life.
So, friends, we are delighted here today to welcome to this discussion Dr. Robin Pierucci and also Katie Short. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for
having
us.
It's good to be here, Father.
So we've known each other for some time now and have been in this battle against abortion. But the sense we all have really is that we're reaching a very important moment here where significant progress can be made. And of course, we've been educating people about this Supreme Court case. I'd like to talk to both of you about the brief, the friend of the court brief that you submitted together with, I think, an unprecedented number of pro-life briefs when you look at the history of court cases on abortion. But this one in particular that you submitted talks about some of the key medical and legal issues surrounding this whole question of viability, which as we know is key to this case because the court is going to address the question or examine the question, are all pre-viability bans on abortion unconstitutional? I want to look at this then from the, as your brief does, from the medical and the legal angles. And let me start with this this question. It's a fascinating point made in the brief that from a medical perspective, when we talk about viability, the ability of a baby to survive outside the womb, the brief says viability is not a point. It's a prediction. Explain that more to us.
Oh, I'd love to. Viability, you know, this is something that when Roe v. Wade was created, they admit, first of all, that it really was a subjective decision, meaning there's no set point, and yet they placed all this value on it, but only certain people have value, which is kind of crazy to say that a complete human being, which is what the baby in the womb is, they are not sort of human or a little bit human, it is a complete human. At certain points, a court gave them value. And it's all make-believe. Even as a physician, I can't say, a physician, by the way, who does nothing but care for these little ones, I can't tell you that this baby is viable and that one is not by looking at an ultrasound. Or before I have the opportunity to see how the baby responds to medical care, there are certain limits that we always have to admit where the medical technology is, but it's still with an awful lot of humility that we get to meet these little ones. And so where viability is now, compared to where it was when our laws were recreated in 73, is a world of difference. So the law is obsolete. It doesn't reflect today's reality. And so no matter what you think about it, the fact that the law doesn't even reflect appropriately what to predict for what we can do today is a kind of goofy. And so continuing with a law that isn't reality and actually does harm, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, Dr. Robin, let me distinguish this a little bit, because some people, again, they have this idea of viability as a specific point in the spectrum of the development of the baby in the womb, but it's not. But there are certain points, right? I mean, like, for example, I know that at a certain point, the eyelids fuse together, and then later on in development, they separate, right? Now those like are specific points, right? There's a point where the heart starts beating. There's a point where brain waves can be detected. There's a point where all sorts of marvelous things happen, but viability is not like that. It's not like, oh, well, you know, you can expect it to happen, you know, at the end of the sixth week or whatever, any other point, however any other point might be defined. And because it's dependent on so many different factors, right?
Yeah. In fact, gestational age, which is kind of what everyone seems to hang their hat on, is only one of five or six factors which have actually been shown in the medical literature to really, statistically significantly impact whether a baby survives or not. And in fact, how well they survive. So it's not just gestational age. Whether the baby's a boy or a girl actually has an impact. Little girls are tougher. I don't know why, okay, but they are. Same thing, their weight. Babies who are literally too small for us to help, that impacts things. Whether mom had maternal steroids during the pregnancy that help mature the lungs. And one of the, you know, whether it's a single or a multiple, but one of the big factors that was most recently found is what hospital you present to. If you go to a hospital where everybody is all in, where they are prepared and they agree that they're going to attempt to resuscitate the baby, boy, those hospitals have far better outcomes than the ones that have predetermined that at a certain gestational age, they're not going to do anything. Well, zero babies survive that. By the hospital, when you have a team that is devoted to caring for the baby and agrees that this is reasonable, the babies literally, they do better, not just in surviving, but their long-term outcomes. And by the way, the hospitals who refuse to do anything with just a strict gestational age cutoff, the ones just above that gestational age, usually their outcomes aren't as good as some of the other hospitals.
It's fascinating. And it's so helpful to see, these different factors that are involved. Yeah. Katie, let's turn to some of the legal arguments here, because building on this medical insight about viability, the brief goes on to make the argument that using this as a constitutional boundary between when a state may or may not protect the lives of these babies is both illogical and unworkable. Explain to us, Katie, if you will, from a constitutional angle, what those arguments mean in this brief.
It's illogical, because what the court was saying is, if a baby could survive outside the womb, then we will protect it in the womb. Then no, you can't touch it. Leave it alone. Leave it in the womb if it could survive outside the womb. On the other hand, if it can't survive outside the womb, then go ahead. You can go ahead and deliberately kill it in the womb. That's where the illogic comes in. It just makes no sense. As we said in the brief, it's like saying, well, if we said, you know, the idea of a pool safe child is the child who, if it happens to fall in a pool, if it's reached a certain age, it has a good chance of not drowning. It'll paddle over to the side or something like that. So in that case, the state can prevent that child from being tossed into a pool. But if a child is not pool safe, well, then go ahead. You can hold its head underwater and drown it. That's the sort of illogic involved. As far as the workability, it's unworkable both for the reasons that Robin was just describing. You know, there is no point to viability, and it is really, viability is largely assessed after the baby's born. That's when you can really do an assessment of viability, not before it's born. And then the next issue is just the fact that the Supreme Court, even the post viability, hedged that in with it. They left it completely to the abortion provider to decide when a baby is viable, and they are not the experts. You know, the abortion providers do not know. They are sometimes not even obstetricians, much less neonatologists, who can make this judgment. And then the third sort of indicia minutia of unworkability is that the you borders using viability as a benchmark. They talk in terms of weeks. That's how they advertise. And we actually included screenshots of abortion advertisements in our brief to make this point. They don't say we do abortions up to viability. They say we do abortions up to 24 weeks or 26 weeks or shockingly up to 32 weeks or 35 weeks. And that was our, we wanted to drive home that point. No abortionist is talking about viability. They're talking, they because they know that it's just it was just a term, they can't rely on it. The Supreme Court put this huge weight on it of being the quote unquote point at which would determine where a state can protect a child or not.
And even in Roe v. Wade, if I recall, they said, well, viability, it's probably around 28 weeks, but some would put it at 24 weeks. So even though they're using it as a point constitutionally, they're even admitting that there's this wide range of difference, right?
Right. And the really scary thing is allowing the abortion providers. I mean, and they said, it's not just they, 28 weeks, 24 weeks. They're basically saying, the abortion provider can make that call for every single pregnancy. So what sort of enforceability can a state have when, how does a state ever go in and say, we are going to force a post-viability abortion ban when it is totally up to the abortion provider to make that call? And one more point is, and what difference does it make given that in Roe and Doe together, they basically said, and if it is post-viability, abortion can still be done for the health of the woman. Health was defined extremely broadly. So another form maybe the abortion provider has to fill out saying, depression or anxiety or something like that.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And let's go to that point about the abortionist being the one to use viability as a dividing line. And Robin, let's go back to you. I mean, they're not the ones, and the brief makes this argument. Why are they not the ones who are even qualified to assess viability?
Physicians. So that they would know what the standard of care is just not even probably available to them. But even the obstetricians, when, the people doing this, obstetricians train very differently than a neonatologist. They go through internal medicine, into obstetrics. I'm a pediatrician who then stayed on as a neonatologist for an additional fellowship. So my entire training is geared very differently about how do I help the baby. They have a very different outlook. And ACOG, even in all of their statements, they make it very clear over and over and over, even when you have a baby who has some other additional diagnoses that are going to make their life challenging. They like beat the head over the obstetricians in their literature saying, you have to, not optional, you have to make sure you keep offering the mom an abortion, as opposed to how do I walk with you? How do I care for you? How do I care with the baby? I mean, that's just, it's so odd to me that there's permission to abandon the baby as opposed to this. I think John Paul II said it the best. He calls it this misplaced beneficence. Oh, if I just get rid of the baby, that's going to solve everything.
Right.
Not so much.
No, exactly. Well, there's another, I find just very, very fascinating argument in the brief here. And Katie, I'd like you to comment on this one. It's we know that as the court has dealt with the abortion question and this question of viability, the courts have held that the more that the baby is capable of independent life outside the womb, the more compelling becomes the interest of the state in protecting that baby. And yet the state doesn't have to. right from Roe v. Wade, it's clear that the state can allow, as some states do, absolutely unrestricted abortion right up until birth. But in the brief, the argument is made that, well, what should really be said here is that after the baby is capable of life outside the womb, the state not just may protect the baby, but that the state must protect the baby. Tell us about this particular argument in the brief.
I made that argument because I was concerned, as I think many of us are concerned, that some of the justices will look for some sort of middle ground, you know, and the middle ground would be somewhere between, you know, keeping Roe pure and undefiled versus overturning Roe and sending it back to the states. I wanted to show, no, there's another position, which is the 14th Amendment affirmatively provides protection for the unborn. That's what you, if you're looking for the middle, then in that case, if you're looking for the middle ground is to allow, you know, is just reversing Roe and the states make their own judgment about it, about how to deal with it. And so that was, so I wanted to bring the discussion over to that area of 14th Amendment protection. And it struck me that, you know, that the Supreme Court rattled off this about the point of viability is the point at which the state may protect. And I thought, you know, wouldn't it be just as logical to say the state must protect at that point?
Right.
And many people, you know, there are scholars who have made that argument, and some of them actually have, you know, filed briefs, you know, other amicus briefs. And, you know, one of the problems with making that argument is that it's just really hard to wrap your head around how that would work. And so, again, kind of in the spirit of show, don't tell, I wanted to say, well, here's a concrete example. We don't have to worry about, you know, the very, you know, from the moment of conception or something like that. Let's just talk about what is our national scandal here, compared to, you know, almost every country in the world, is the availability of abortion, you know, throughout pregnancy. So isn't that at least something that we could say, you know, if we're going to talk about viability, that's how viability, if it has a purpose in this discussion at all, that's where it should come in, is at least after the point at which the baby could survive outside the womb, you may not, the states must give it the same protection as older human beings.
You know, it's and that has always appeared to me to be what the ultimate goal needs to be of our movement. Because if we're talking about, as we obviously are, the killing of innocent human life, then how can it make any sense ultimately that, hey, you can do it in, you know, you can do it in New York, but you can't do it in Alabama. You know, it's like, what is that? You know, it's ultimately a weakening of the clear concept that, no, we are indeed talking about something just as morally prohibited as, you know, going out onto the street and shooting somebody with no reason whatsoever. So yes, I was happy to see that particular argument, because we've got to get to the point where we're talking about that and talking about it very clearly in terms of the duty of the state to protect these lives. Well, it's certainly something that I want to encourage people to read, this brief. It can be found with all the other briefs online. We have a special webpage, supremecourtvictory.com, on which we have information about the case, links to all the briefs, as well as a prayer campaign for the good outcome of this particular case. So, brothers and sisters, we want to urge you to go there, supremecourtvictory.com. And I want to thank you, Katie Short, for your legal expertise, not only in this case, but like I say, we've known each other for many years, and I've seen you hard at work in so many different dimensions of this fight for life. And I want to thank you for that, for all that you've done over all these years. And I'm sure the Lord has a lot more work for you to do in the years to come. And Dr. Robin Pierucci, for your work in neonatology and taking care of those little tiny babies, your work, you know, running a NICU unit. I think people are just, you know, always, I've found, always inspired hearing about that kind of work. for these tiny babies who are so often struggling for life, and you are leading the way among the medical professionals in making sure they have a chance for that life. So thank you for the work that you do as well. Thank you both for this fascinating conversation and for your contribution to this very important Supreme Court case.
Thanks, Father.
This has been the End Abortion Podcast. To learn more, to help end abortion, and to connect with us on social media, visit endabortion.net.